You know, I'm just going to keep repeating it to myself over and over again. Lauren Weinstein, Lauren Weinstein. I always somehow screw that up. It's Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, a face for radio and a voice for print. Coming up next hour, Sun Tzu's The Art of War, how it would change the way in which we are engaged in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the war against terror, what we could learn from a 2,500-year-old book, The Art of War, Sun Tzu. We'll talk about it with an expert, Gary Gagliardi. Watch, it'll turn out to be Gary Gagliardi, and I'll get names wrong all night long. Looking forward to talking to Lauren Weinstein later on this hour, though. We'll get into some of the latest on privacy issues, and there's a lot to get to in the time that we'll have. We may even throw the phone numbers out, too, so you can join in the conversation on Coast to Coast AM. Last week, I mentioned that I wasn't worried about the standoff that was happening between leaders of that so-called fundamentalist Mormon polygamist cult in Texas and the sheriff's department that led the raid on the compound. And as I said, this polygamist cult seems less about dying to make some sort of, you know, twisted statement and more about unattractive older white guys being unable, you know, to figure out any other way they can to have sex with young teenage girls in the name of God. So they created a cult. But I think I underestimated just how dark that group really is. If the press reports are true about what that cult has been up to, it's even creepier than I thought. You know, the world is full of twisted people. Most of them, though, are wearing ties. They're mowing their lawns. They're hiding in plain sight in the bright of day. So, evening to you, people of the night. Though it may be dark, you are the people of the light. And we'll continue to bring light on some very interesting subjects coming up tonight. For example, more government secrets about microscopic creepy crawlies, meteorites, Mexican UFOs and drones from space, and more when we do crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Nice to have Nikki back at the con tonight, driving the show, and I hope Miguel has a great night off. Washington for crypto news first. The only U.S. facility allowed to research the highly contagious foot and mouth disease experienced several accidents with the feared virus, the Bush administration acknowledged on Friday. A 1978 release of hoof and mouth, or foot and mouth disease, they call it here, but into a cattle holding pens on Plum Island triggered new safety procedures. While that incident was previously unknown, the Homeland Security told the House committee there were other incidents inside the government's laboratory. It's kind of funny here. I think the way they wrote it is sort of telling. They said the contagious foot and mouth disease, most people call it hoof and mouth, but with the Bush administration, sometimes it has been foot and mouth. Anyway, the accidents are significant because the administration is likely to move research from this remote island to one of five sites on the U.S. mainland near livestock herds. This story about these previous releases of the virus into the atmosphere raises concerns about the risks of catastrophic outbreak. It does not sicken humans, of course, but can devastate the livestock industry. Gee, I wonder what else they haven't told us yet, because they haven't had to. From fizorg.com, this story: imagine being able to take a step back in time and walk through the streets of ancient Pompeii just hours before the eruption of Vesuvius. In April 2008, sometime later on this month, European researchers will demonstrate that walking through virtual environments is set to be a reality. Quote, in the virtual environment, you will have flight simulators and car simulators, but the most natural way of locomotion for humans is walking. And this was practically impossible, said the coordinator of what's called the CyberWalk Project. To make virtual walking a reality, CyberWalk researchers had to address five key issues: providing a surface to walk on, controlling the surface in a way that minimized forces on the user, developing a non-intrusive tracking system, displaying a high-quality visualization, and ensuring a natural human perception of the virtual environment. Kind of cool. Imagine being able to take a walk in virtual reality, or what we here in the upper Midwest call spring, which is still not happening yet. Scientists have developed a new way of determining the size and frequency of meteorites that have collided with the Earth. Their work shows that the size of the meteorite that will likely plummet to Earth can be measured by the amount that's left behind of certain trace elements. This they are linking to the story of the KT, the famous meteorite that plummeted to Earth around the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary 65 million years ago. They're saying that was 4 to 6 kilometers in diameter. The meteorite was the trigger, scientists believe, for the massive extinction of dinosaurs and other life forms. This new measuring model for meteorites, also a story at physorg.com. This new method uses this new analysis that's an improvement over the old method where scientists would just stand around a big hole saying, gosh, that's a really big hole. IBM scientists unveiled a major breakthrough in their effort to build a new class of memory nicknamed racetracks. A diagram of the nanowire shows an electric current is used to slide tiny magnetic patterns around the nanowire track, where the device can read and write data in less than a nanosecond. The racetrack memory would stand billions of nanowires around the edge of a single chip. Billions of nanowires around the edge of a single chip. This has the potential to allow hundreds of times the amount of storage in the same space as today's memory. And besides being practically indestructible, potentially unleashing applications that nobody has even imagined yet. Uncovering a rare 2-billion-year-old window into the Earth's mantle, a University of Houston professor and his team have found our planet's geological history is more complex than previously thought. A story for Crypto News also comes from physorg.com, great science site. Jonathan Snow, assistant professor of geosciences at the University of Houston, led a team of researchers in a North Pole expedition, resulting in a discovery that could shed new light on this mantle, this vast layer that lies beneath the planet's outer crust. We're talking about 2-billion-year-old rocks that time forgot, found along the bottom of the Arctic Ocean floor. Saw that story, couldn't help but wonder what Neil Adams, last week's guest, would think of that. If you haven't heard that show, you got to go back into the archives on Coast to Coast AM and listen to Neil Adams talking about Batman for like the first two-thirds of the show. But we did get around eventually to talking about his Earth expansion theory and how the Earth has been accumulating material on the crust, not working out from the middle. Greenville, South Carolina, a Greenville County woman is working with her beekeeper to rid her home of 60,000 bees living in the walls of her house for a month. 60,000 bees. WYFF-TV reported that Jane Walcott is allergic to bees and has been sleeping with anti-allergy medication near her bed to give herself an emergency shot if stung. Hello, Motel 6? What are you waiting for? I'm allergic to bees, too. I'm just getting hives thinking about that. Beekeeper Charlie Holden said that it will take a few weeks to remove the bees, which he hopes to move to where? His house. The beekeeper Charlie Holden says he already has about 3 million bees. So looking at about 60,000 more. Talk about being totally in the right business, you know, getting bees out of other people's houses and you happen to collect them. My wife wouldn't let me bring home one bee. I couldn't bring home one bee in a box. Not that I'd want to, but I can imagine coming home with another 60,000 in the trunk. From Live Science, Ethan Katz Bassett, a graduate student in computer science at the University of Washington, and his advisor designed a program to continuously search for strange internet gaps, so-called black holes in the internet. When a request to visit a website or an outgoing email gets lost along a pathway that was once known to be working. Think about that. The number of times you've been logging on to something or sending an email to somebody and you know it went through before. There's no message that pops up that says it was returned, yet the person never gets it on the other end. Could it be a black hole? To make sure that black holes they detect are not simply due to a problem with the end user or the host server, they took computers that can be reached for some but not all of the internet, meaning the issue must be occurring en route. Quote, we were astounded when we did an initial four-month study and we saw how many problems there were, Katz Bassett told Live Science. It seemed infeasible that this could be happening so often, these black holes. They're definitely more common than we thought. Yeah, judging by my spam file, there's only one way apparently to make sure that your email is indestructible. Somewhere on it, the words discount Viagra must appear. And then don't worry, it'll get through. By the way, more on spam and virus attacks in just a moment. We'll talk with Lauren Weinstein. Lauren Weinstein. I'm going to get it right this time. I keep wanting to call him Weinstein. I know it's wrong, but it always comes out that way first. Wiretapping and government surveillance and oversight issues are also coming up. We'll talk with Lauren in just a second about ISPs invading the privacy of customers by tracking where they go and now what they search for on other sites. Also, network neutrality issues more generally, internet censorship by countries, services, et cetera. We'll get a lot of stuff coming up here in just a minute with Lauren. Mexico, crews of five airliners report UFO activity. Five. Ana Luisa Seed wrote, five airliner crews reported UFO sightings over Mexico on March 23rd of this year. All witnesses agreed on the traffic being intensely brilliant, with lights resembling airliner strobes, white and intermittent. The objects were described as brilliant spheres that were also surrounded by lights. One of the pilots, the one who flew closest to the UFOs, added that they had a Pentagon-shaped base. The objects went up and down, making movements that could be matched, that could not be matched by an airliner. And at that time, they were flying at about 25,000 feet, 70 miles northwest of Guadalajara. This brings us to tomorrow night's show on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be doing Sunday night. Ed Grimsley and Charles Osman. Good to talk to Charles Osman again. But we're doing something a little different than the last time Charles was on. UFO sightings and battles with night vision goggles. I haven't had a chance to check into much about this show, but what I hear, it just trips me out because I have some night vision goggles and I can't wait to go out and play around with them. The things that we're told you can see with night vision goggles, we'll hear their testimony on it coming up tomorrow night. And finally, in crypto news from Fort Morgan, Alabama, several unmanned military drones with U.S. Air Force markings washed ashore in Alabama and forced the closure of a portion of at least one beach. Two men on spring break in the area found the first 20-foot-long drone on the shore near Fort Morgan. An official said it was a military shooting target that was shot down in the Gulf of Mexico. And after it hit the water, it couldn't float, so it droned. Sorry. I guess that's a good intro for Lauren Weinstein. Hey, Lauren.
Hey, greetings, Ian. How are you?
Okay, I better bring in reinforcements here before I get in more trouble.
I'm still picturing these walls full of honey at that
time. I know. Isn't that amazing? 60,000 bees in your walls. I've been in cheap hotels where you can hear the walls buzzing like that, but it's usually kind of those vibrating beds on the other side. I can't imagine what that would be like. So Lauren, I read a quick list here of some of the things that are going on. I want to start with this story about spam and virus attacks. Is there anything really new to report on that, or that's just the usual kind of, isn't it a drag?
Yeah, it keeps getting worse and worse. It's like entropy, right? I mean, it's all leading toward the end eventually. There's continuing research, and the problem, of course, is that whatever we try to throw at it, it evolves very quickly, and basically, there's no dramatic solutions or lights at the ends of the tunnels right now that I have to report. It's just bad, unless you like the blue pill ads, as you noted.
Right, yeah, which I guess never get tired of.
You know, a lot of those that look like spams are actually viruses. That's something that might be worth mentioning here.
Well, tell me about that, because I was actually telling Nikki before I went on the air, it's running the board, we were talking about getting an email, and she'd sent me an email, and I went into my box, and I had one person sent an email that replicated 2,000 times. I mean, it's just enough to, I mean, it was a total spam, but it seemed like a spam slash virus.
Yeah, well, a lot of these, you sometimes get these that are very, very short, you know, and have a lot of misspellings in them and just seem infantile in various ways. And the payload in those is really just the URL.
Okay.
And the whole point of that message is to make it short enough that spam filters can't key in on it very effectively, because there's just not a lot there to analyze, and to try to get people to click on that URL. And if you follow those URLs back, they'll almost inevitably lead to Thailand or China or somewhere like that. They're throwaway domains that only exist for a few days. And the whole idea is to get you to go there to try to contaminate your browser with a virus.
You know, I get them so much now that anytime I look at the word Viagra and a G hasn't been replaced by the number 9, it looks incorrectly spelled to me now. I'm so used to seeing it with Viagra with a 9 instead of a G.
The latest thing that's happening now I'm noticing is that they evolve. They're the same spam bot systems, but as time goes by, they change their dialogue. Some of them are now using current events. So they'll throw a headline at you that says protests about Chinese Olympics, read here, and things like that.
Right.
Just anything to try to get you to click on the URL. So just don't do it.
No. So you are going to pick up, though, on a story which I reported in Crypto News just a couple of weeks ago about ISPs that were invading the privacy of customers by tracking where they go and what they research, that if you actually look at the fine print of every ISP contract that you sign, you have virtually no rights.
It's really pretty amazing. A lot of the things that ISPs have written into their terms of service, their TOSs, if the phone companies, and of course we're dealing with the same companies, but if these same companies did this with conventional telephone service, it would be considered a privacy violation or even wiretapping. But because we don't currently consider internet services to be in the same category as conventional telephone services, they don't have the same protections. And the ISPs have basically been going hog wild recently, trying to figure out ways to monetize. That's the key word here.
Right.
Everything that you do on the internet. And some of the things that they're starting to do now are really quite fascinating, and you wouldn't believe that they would go this far, because it seems to me that it's going to trigger legislative action most likely, because it's just beyond the pale in some cases.
Well, it may, but I even think even there is the genie already out of the bottle for that, because of all of the Homeland Security issues it will be harder to get legislation for internet privacy, with all the claims that if they do that, then there's no way we'll be able to stop the terrorists.
I think that there is enough, there are enough cool heads prevailing on this to strike a reasonable balance. But when you have ISPs saying that they want to actually read your traffic to see what you're searching for on other sites, so that they can send you ads based on what you're doing with someone else, That's pretty dramatic. In other words, you go to Google and you search for something, your ISP is going to essentially spy on the fact that you searched for this at Google and wants to make use of that information. Now, the people that are pushing this right now, this has advanced the most in Great Britain, where there's a company called Form, which has made deals, which may fall apart now. It's not clear. The publicity has been pretty awful about this for them.
Well,
with the big ISPs over there, and the idea literally was that they say, well, we have wonderful anonymization techniques, we have privacy built in, we can't connect anybody with who searches for what and all that. I don't care.
Right.
I don't care how well they anonymize these things. When I'm talking to a third-party site, whether it's Google or Yahoo or
whatever,
psycho babble news, it doesn't make any difference to me. I want privacy. That's a communication between me and them. The ISP is supposed to be moving my bits around and not spying on them for their own money-making purposes. I'm sorry, I'm conservative that way.
Well, I don't blame it. It would be a little bit like the post office getting
opening
into the business.
Envelopes.
looking inside your envelopes and going, we see that you're ordering a lot of magazines that have to do with woodworking. Can we sell you a new, you know, saw?
Bingo.
And I do think that that is weird. There are some ISPs, though, and it does open the door for certain ISPs to offer that guarantee. And I think that's good news for boutique ISPs who don't want to get into that business. I happen to frequent one here in Minnesota called Vizzy, and that's their guarantee. Is essentially their guarantee is, we don't care about you. We're not interested in your life.
I think some of the big ISPs have that same "we don't care about you" philosophy, but in a slightly different, from a slightly different angle.
Yeah. Well, this is the good one. This is the good way, which is just do what you want to do and only call us if you've got a problem, and we're all good. I like that. All right, so we'll come back. Lauren Weinstein, hanging on, and we'll run you the numbers too, so you can join in the conversation. Other ways in which your privacy is being compromised. Next on Coast to Coast AM. There you go. In order of Lauren Weinstein, talking about internet privacy issues. And we shot you the numbers just in case you had any questions for it. We'll be talking about a bunch of things, including the government intrusion stories of the last couple of weeks of crypto news, wiretapping and government surveillance and oversight. What's the latest on that, and net neutrality and more coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Lauren Weinstein, let's back up for just a second here and finish that lesson we were talking about ISPs. I think there are good ones and bad ones, obviously. What are the most, I mean, you talked about some of the sales pitch ideas that they're going to monitor that, or they're going to monetize your internet clicks in order for them to sell that research, to package it together and sell the research or something. What are some of the worst ways that that could go that either you imagine or that you've already seen evidence of for ISPs to spy on your every email and your every click?
Well, you mean beyond just the generic privacy issue that's involved saying you shouldn't be doing that.
What's the worst case scenario for that?
Well, the big problem that comes up is that when you build that kind of infrastructure into your network, this is kind of similar to the wiretapping situation, actually, in an interesting way. When you build the kind of infrastructure in, what that's really called is deep packet inspection, to start getting technical about it, DPI. And that means that you're not just routing packets from place to place, users' packets. You're actually digging deep into them and trying to look at the content. Like you made the analogy of the post office, right? It's opening the envelope, not just looking at the address and sending the envelope along, opening it up, pulling out the contents, peering at it, going, that's kind of interesting, and then, you know, sealing it closed again with some masking tape or something. And deep packet inspection, obviously, once you've built it into your network, you can use it for more than just grabbing someone's search term and anonymizing it and using it. You could hold on to the search term. You could put it into a database. You could make it available to authorities on a simple phone call. I mean, there's any manner of things that can be done once you've built that kind of system up and you have it available.
I guess that's where I'm going with, because it seems like the worst case scenario here is would be almost blackmail. I mean, I think it would almost be, if you want us to not look at your email, to pay extra. If you don't pay us extra, we will look at your email, but you can pay for the privacy gold package.
Well,
I just keep thinking the possibilities exist somewhere of them being able to monetize that by squeezing the consumer.
I think the key aspect here has to do with choice. Many people right now rely on their ISPs to do spam filtering, however effective or ineffective it might be. You know, the term spam as we use it today does come from Monty Python, by the way.
Oh, does it really?
Yes, it comes from the Viking skit where they kept breaking into the people in the restaurant and they wanted spam, eggs and spam. And the Vikings get wonderful spam.
Right.
That's where it comes from, because they kept interrupting. It was a continuous interruption, and that's how it got started. It actually started with Usenet news groups and then worked its way into email later. Interesting little tidbit that you didn't.
No, I think that's very interesting, because I would have thought it had to do more with the product itself.
Not
as
at all.
Being,
no,
oh, that's so no interesting.
Connection,
I think,
except for the fact that they were talking about that product in the skit.
Yeah.
Because that's what they were ordering. Spam,
spam,
eggs, and spam.
Right. So if they had been breaking in and saying bacon instead of spam, And the Vikings kept saying bacon, 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 bacon. We'd be calling it. I've got a lot of bacon in my email.
You've got it, and Hormel would have probably been happier about.
I know they would have been happy with that. I know somebody works down there. They would have been a lot happier with that. So, but go back to that idea again of ISPs that are spying and exactly. I mean, once you've signed a contract with them, that they could possibly be in a position where you have to pay extra in order for them to stay out of your business.
I don't think we're going to probably reach that point because I think if they push that hard, I think there'll be a legislative pushback. But the way to avoid that is to make a lot of these things voluntary. In other words, if you want to gain the benefits of having targeted advertising based on your searches at other sites, you want that advertising coming from your ISP, then you should be able to opt into that. The problem comes up mainly when it's the default condition. Now, I should mention the form project, for example, there's supposed to be an opt-out procedure. Now, these different systems will have different opt-out procedures. Some of them require that you maintain certain cookies on your browser. That could be a problem for people that wipe out their cookies all the time because of privacy concerns. Others will allow you to block a particular website, and that will turn it off. Others have other techniques. Some of them will only work with email. There's all kinds of things all over the place. But really the important characteristic from my standpoint is if you want to voluntarily opt into something like that, fine, do it. It's only when you're forced to opt out that the problems really start to get severe because we know most people won't know what's going on. They won't opt out. And of course, that's why these things are always set up this way. They will promote them and say, we're providing a wonderful service to people. But then you say, fine, why don't you make it voluntary? And they go, we don't want to do that. I mean, they can opt out. And the reason they don't want people they don't want to make it opt in is they know that if it's opt in, most people won't opt in.
They'll have fewer adopters. You know, but that's, again, I come back to that. I mean, you pay extra for them to not publish your number. Right, you pay extra with a phone company to keep your number off of the books. Well, that always seemed kind of weird.
The argument there has been that it costs extra money to send the guy with the eraser over to the database, right?
Right.
So and once you get that kind of thing on the books, it tends to perpetuate
like tollways.
Yeah.
All right. So you're going to tie this into the government spying piece, and then we'll get some calls in.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting because there's a continuing concern about the extent to which the conventional telephone network, the plain old telephone service, the POTS network, has been re-engineered over the last few years to make wiretaps very, very simple. Not just wiretaps, but also the handing over of transactional data, who you called, when you called, where you were when you called, all those kinds of things, which, by the way, takes a much lower level of legal requirement. In other words, you don't have to have a court order normally to get that kind of transactional data. Typically, you need a court order in most situations to get the contents of a call. But there's a real controversy right now over to what extent the network allows outside entities, whether it's the FBI or some other three-letter agency, to gain their own access to the network. The official pronouncements of the phone companies basically have been that they can't do that, that they can't automatically just reach in and grab that kind of data without cooperation in each case from a telephone company employee, essentially. But there are people who have worked on the telephone network who have been talking to Congress and talking to investigators and saying they worked on systems that did allow that kind of unfettered access to the network, and this has gotten some people in Congress rather concerned because there are legitimate reasons to wonder how far this has gone, given that we know of abuses. I mean, there was a whole set of abuses that the FBI owned up to that occurred in their procedures. And the easier it is to do wiretapping and the easier it is to get that kind of data in a kind of frictionless way, the more likely it is that we're going to see situations where mistakes are made or where overzealous investigators get at data that they shouldn't. And I think that should concern most people.
What's the status on the absolution for the phone companies for having given the data or cooperated with the government in creating these these little back rooms where the government could put their little spy bots on the systems.
Yeah, that's a very interesting aspect of this. This was the big push. You may have seen all the ads on television. There was a group that for a while was running a lot of advertising saying, tell Congress to vote the Telecom Act exactly as provided by the Bush administration. And what's really been holding up that act is this issue of retroactive immunity, which is to say that you want to wipe out all the lawsuits that are currently pending against the phone companies for what are viewed by many observers as illicit wiretapping and illicit operations. Not so much because you want to say that it was a mistake for them to cooperate with the government in what may have been an illegal wiretapping project, but if you wipe out all the lawsuits, you can't do the discovery and you can't find out whatever really happened. So there's both aspects to this.
So where does it stand?
Essentially what happened is that the Senate went along with this and the House actually stood firm and the House wouldn't go along. And it's kind of in limbo right now. There was talk of a compromise, but it stalled. And I think what will probably happen in the end, if someone really forced me to take a guess at it, would be that a lot of the legal jeopardy aspects of this will be transferred over to the government. In other words, a lot of this will proceed, but perhaps the monetary risk will be moved to the government instead of from the phone companies. I'm sure that delights taxpayers. But it could go in lots of other ways, too. Okay. This thing has turned in so many strange ways, but it is still pending. I mean, that's really the simple answer.
We know you'll keep an eye on it for us, and thank you. Lauren Weinstein, we'll get to some phone calls in just a second. The Art of War from Sun Tzu, how would that explain what we should do next in Iraq, in Afghanistan? We'll talk about that with our guest next hour on Coast to Coast AM. First, let's grab a couple of calls. East of the Rockies, Steve is in Connecticut for Lauren Weinstein on Coast to Coast AM. Steve, Lauren Weinstein, privacy expert, taking your call. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, thanks. My question is, this problem of everybody knowing what websites you go to and what you do on them, can you be protected from that if you go to one of these places that has the Wi-Fi, or are you protected? I don't think this one will be an answer yes, but I'd like to know if you use one of those cards on a laptop so you get connected through a cell phone company. And the last one is, what about when you use a library but they make you log in through your library card?
Right. Well, the library one is kind of obvious. I mean, anytime there's identity, there's a track. And essentially, every connection in the Internet, and this is an oversimplification, but for all practical purposes, every connection can be tracked one way or another. The issue is whether the identity of the person is known. Obviously, if you walk into a library and you're not identified in some way and you walk up to a terminal and connect to Google and type a few search terms and walk out, there's not going to be a lot to connect you to anything. But anytime you use your own computer or you go to a friend's computer or something like that, when you use these Wi-Fi systems, they can collect certain information sometimes from your computer that can theoretically be identified. There's the capability of a track being left. Now, that doesn't mean that track is easy to figure out or that it would be worth the effort in most cases for anybody to gather together all the bits and pieces of information necessary to track down a given connection. But from a technical standpoint, the Internet really does not have a lot of anonymity. And even when you have encryption, the information about where you connected to would tend to still exist. There are systems that have been set up that try to obscure things by going from site to site to site to site to site, onion layers of an onion type systems. Some of those work in some ways. Some of them have problems in some ways. But really, it's most realistic just to always think in terms of the fact that the Internet is basically not an anonymous medium.
It's a window,
and that's really the way it is. It's not anonymous. You just have to live with it right now.
Let's go first time caller line. Derek is in Costa Mesa, California, on Coast to Coast AM for privacy expert Lauren Weinstein. Go ahead, Derek.
Hello, fellas.
Hey.
Now I expect that we have privacy against the government, but when I was hearing you speak earlier, it seemed like you were against the, so-called right to privacy From the producers themselves, or the
against the right to privacy? I don't think against the right to privacy.
How did you get he was against the right to privacy?
Oh no, I'm sorry. I got the impression that he was in favor of it. But what I'm asking is, I would expect that we'd have a right to privacy from the government, but from an independent source, do we have a right to privacy? Because
like a constitutional right to privacy?
Oh no, right. we don't. Clearly, in the current legal environment from ISPs generally, because they have a very special legal position right now. Now, if we extended common carrier law, which is where the regular telephone industry operates pretty much, if we extended common carrier considerations to ISPs, which is something that we would expect them to fight tooth and nail, that could bring them into the same kind of privacy regime that we have with the ordinary phone companies. But in the current legal environment, the current legislative environment, I agree. They can pretty much put whatever they want in the terms of service, and you got to live with it.
Thank you, Derek. We'll go west of the Rockies, where Blair is in Sedona, Arizona, on Coast to Coast AM for privacy expert Lauren Weinstein. Go ahead, Blair.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Lauren, you know, I'm going to sort of wax a little philosophical because of our capitalism that's now unchecked. We got these massive private property interests that seem to be trumping long-term societal ideals, you know? And
some kind of communist?
Well, I'm not speaking in those terms. I'm not talking in polarity consciousness,
okay,
of either or. I'm talking about a balance. You know, the Greeks say in all things moderation. But if we have businessmen running the planet, we need to change this paradigm from them considering this a gigantic monopoly board into a living being. I think that'd be one of the first steps. Otherwise, we're just treating symptoms.
You're not going to get an argument from me.
Yeah, I think you pretty much get an amen from the whole congregation on that one. Let's go to Steve Wildcard Line, San Diego, on Coast to Coast AM for Lauren Weinstein, privacy expert. Steve?
Ian, good morning. Lauren, glad to hear this. I had an episode a couple days ago with my new AT&T landline, which they would not give me without the DSL or vice versa.
And I had vice versa, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's supposed to be, there were supposed to have been changes to allow what's, you know, called naked DSL, but it's not always economical to
No, but what I had on my first regular monthly bill from them were two $14.95 charges from third-party billers, they told me. And we don't know who they are. We don't know why they're attached to your phone number. So I investigated further, and I called these so-called third-party billers. And by law, AT&T is not allowed to find out who they are, why they're on my bill, but somebody attached my phone number to these two services.
Yeah, you can still, but AT&T will still pull those charges off.
Well, that's not the problem. I'm wondering who attached.
Who are they?
Attached my phone number?
What was the billing service for?
Professional voicemail services.
Yeah, these are real typical. You don't really have to worry too much about how they got your number because they essentially just do this at random. A lot of them they pull numbers out of the air and just bill to them, and the system allows that to happen.
That's exactly right. And what AT&T told me, I went all the way to the supervisor, and she told me we're not allowed to inquire who they are. If they send us a bill by FCC regulations, we have to put that on your bill.
That is
what
exactly
a scam.
True.
And what a scam.
Oh, total.
So they just like create a program, a computer program to run numbers at random and just see how many stick.
It's done a lot with text messaging scams too. Those are really nasty.
Oh, wow. Sorry about that, Steve. Let me get one more in here from Jim east of the Rockies in Florida. Thanks for your question. And Jim, you're talking with Lauren Weinstein, privacy expert on Coast to Coast AM. Got to keep it quick, though, Jim.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was wondering if I could reply to any of these spams with an impossible equation, such as the square root of pi.
They'll never see it, and they don't care.
So
you know what,
mess up their machine?
There's nothing. You'll never get anything back to them. It doesn't make any difference. It's a one-way transaction for all practical purposes. Don't waste
okay,
your
just
time.
Thought I'd try.
I appreciate that, Jim. And I got to say, if you're in Florida, that means it's 2 o'clock in the morning And for you to say, good afternoon, gentlemen, I like the world you're living in. You are like either 12 hours ahead of us or 12 hours behind. I'm not sure.
He didn't say he was. He was actually, you know, well, all right.
In Florida.
Exactly,
well.
Yeah.
All right. So let me just, maybe it's a Florida state of mind is what it is. Lauren Weinstein, always a pleasure. And do what you can to stay in touch, would you, on this issue and whether or not we can fight this so that eventually we can have discovery for these lawsuits and we don't give immunity to the phone companies for doing what they knew was wrong in the first place. They were just given a wink and a nudge that said, don't worry, we'll cover you.
You need but call, and I am always available to try to solve these insoluble problems.
Very good. Thank you, Lauren. Appreciate it. God bless you. Have a great night. By the way, if you're looking for a website to go to that won't get you in any trouble, you can try one that I put up tonight. Actually, a little earlier in the week, it's called prayersoftruth.com. Prayersoftruth.com. It's a little project I'm working on. Let me know what you think. Coming up next hour, then we'll get to it. The Art of War, Sun Tzu. How would he get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan? And how would he fight terrorism on Coast to Coast AM?